candidate. My guest today is Jeff Shessel, author of Supreme Power, and our subject is FDR, the Supreme Court, and the battle over its reorganization in the 1930s. Program The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM.
America's great community radio station. This is New York State's most influential radio station, local and vocal, WVOX, where many different voices are heard in the land, every day and every night. And now all over the world at WVOX.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lori London. Presidential pressure to revamp the financial regulatory industry.
I'm actually confident that we can work out a effective bipartisan package that assures that we never have too big to fail again.
Amid sharp partisan differences, the president meeting with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. To try or not to try terrorists in civilian courts, Attorney General Eric Holder in the Capitol Hill hot seat.
Do you really believe that if we capture bin Laden or any al-Qaeda leaders, the first question we should ask is, do you want a lawyer?
Senate Judiciary Ranking Republican Jeff Sessions hopes Holder will reconsider bringing suspects to New York.
No final decision has been made about the forum in which Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his co-defendants will be tried.
Holder says he'll use every tool possible to prosecute terrorists. Fox News. We report, you decide.
Today's public service programs are brought to you by the Burnback Law Firm of White Plains. This famous Manhattan law firm, now in Westchester, is a national leader in workplace job discrimination issues. Headed by attorney Jeffrey M. Burnback, the author of the well-known book, Job Discrimination, How to Fight, How to Win, the classic text informing employees of legal options available in cases of job discrimination, the Burnback Law Firm is located in downtown White Plains at 245 Main Street across from City Center. Airline founder Don Burr says Jeff Burnback's overview and knowledge of job discrimination ranks with other sweeping visions of employee empowerment. Another reviewer said, as a lawyer and public servant, Jeff Burnback has been drawn relentlessly, almost irresistibly, to the side of those who faced discrimination in all its forms. His entire life and law practice are dedicated to those who find themselves without an advocate when the roof caves in at work. Now, all this great knowledge, dedication, and expertise is available in our area at the Burnback Law Firm in White Plains, 914-428-9100, area code 914-428-9100.
A lot of people sell office equipment, copy and fax machines. Some of the technology they're peddling is superb and some of it is not so stellar, I'm afraid. Thus, the dealer you buy from is just as important, you know, as the brand you select. Since 1972, the most respected, reliable dealer has been Vista Business Products. George and Bob Forstbauer's Vista, number one authorized Canon dealer in the tri-state area. They're the oldest and most established. So for the very best up-to-the-minute technology in copying, document management, rely on Vista, the newest technology from the oldest dealer. Westchester headquarters in Elmsford off 287 and 119. Call George or Bob Forstbauer. Their sons George Jr., Bob Jr. There's even a daughter, Christine, in the family business. Vista Business Products and Canon.
Call 914-347-7888 or visit us on the web at www.vistacanon.com.
There are quite a number of neighborhood flower shops around Westchester County these days. As in all things, some are better than others. And in the Colonial Village Shopping Center on Weaver Street in Scarsdale, just to the north of New Rochelle, there exists a florist of very great style and renown. Colonial Village Flowers specializes in beautiful seasonal flowers arranged in good taste, with the lovely low-key result that all Colonial Village presentations, bouquets, and arrangements look like they were actually grown, collected, and gathered in the natural setting of your own garden. Good taste in flowers has for years been a special trademark of Joe Ward and his talented floral arrangers at Colonial Village, featuring the natural look without pomp or ceremony. So please know that there is at least one flower shop on your classy wavelength. Joe Ward's Colonial Village Flowers at 1515 Weaver Street in Scarsdale. Call 723-2888. That's 723-2 and 3/8.
Sunny weather across Westchester County and vicinity this afternoon are highs in the mid to upper 50s and a light northwest breeze. It'll be clear this evening. Partly cloudy overnight, 40 to 45. Mostly sunny on Tuesday. Tuesday's highs in the mid 60s. Partly cloudy at night in the upper 40s. Wednesday sunshine, upper 60s. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for Whitney Media, WVOX, WVIP.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
My guest today is Jeff Shessel, author of Supreme Power, and our subject is FDR, the Supreme Court, and the battle over its reorganization in the 1930s. Getting back to Jeff, getting back to this electoral mandate, and as you mentioned, regarding his overconfidence, that was part of his style. Maybe that was the positive nature and some of the negative nature. How would you think? What's your analysis of Roosevelt in regards to confidence?
Well, he was a supremely self-confident individual, and he projected that from his first moments as president, that wonderful speech in which he tries to dispel fear itself, and in many ways does, just by uttering that line. It wasn't just the words that he said, of course, it was his manner. And mm-hmm. at a time when the nation needed confidence in itself and in its capacity to get out of the Depression, Roosevelt, just by his manner, managed to project that. It was a very, very powerful force. And he was often carried away by it himself. He had a very hard time imagining that he would fail in anything. He was a thoughtful person. He was bold, but he also was very deliberate in how he made decisions. But I think what happened after the 1936 landslide is that he really felt that he had a freer hand than he actually did. The landslide had been so huge, and the mandate was essentially, as he saw it, a blank check. He hadn't run on a series of issues. He hadn't really run on a platform. He said to one of his advisors in 1936, "There's one issue in this election, and it's me."
Right.
And so it was a very personal victory for him, and he really believed that the country had given him a mandate to do essentially whatever he needed to do in order to get past the Supreme Court and to help get the country out of the Depression.
You know, getting into the firestorm of this situation, you know, throughout our history, the amount of justices that sat in the Supreme Court had varied from time to time. It wasn't really in the Constitution how many there should be. And other presidents had recommended changes in size. It started at 6. It went to 10 before the Civil War. It was set by law at 9 in 1869. Why was there such a storm of protest regarding so much of the problems we were facing with this massive victory and popularity only a few months old? What was it? Was it just a situation like today where the Congress just felt that it wanted to establish itself again, its realm of power?
Well, that was part of it. The Congress was tired of taking marching orders from Roosevelt. And even though after 36 he had a bigger majority than ever,
right.
As we see right now, the bigger your majority gets, the harder it is to hold it together.
It's like corralling cats.
Exactly. And I think that he would have been able to hold it together longer if he hadn't opened his second term with something as controversial as packing the court.
Mm.
But just to go back to the first part of your question, you're absolutely right. The number 9 does not appear in the Constitution, but most people probably think that it does, and most people in the 1930s thought that it did as well, because no one was really around to, no one was old enough really to remember that it had ever been anything other than 9. Mm-hmm. You could find it in a history book, but it just wasn't commonly known. And so Roosevelt, reaching back into history, saw that the number of justices had gone up and down a number of times over the course of the 19th century, often for political reasons. So he thought, well, there's a lot of precedent for doing something like this. But the problem with precedent is if no one recognizes it as such, then it seems like a new and radical idea.
Right.
And that's how it struck most Americans.
You know, in trying to understand the political atmosphere of the early 1930s and the opposition to the New Deal, it was basically focused in a group called the Liberty League, and it expanded to more conservative members of the Democratic Party, actually. Who made up the Liberty League, and what had happened to the Republican Party in the early days of the New Deal? Did it fade away?
The Republican Party was at very real risk of fading away, particularly after the 1934 midterms that we talked about. The number of Republicans was dwindling. The party had no real power. The Republican Party had its own divisions to deal with. There was a split in the party between the kind of independent-minded, Western, Teddy Roosevelt-type progressives and the East Coast conservatives who were tied into financial and industrial interests and so forth. So there tended to be a battle within the very small Republican Party. And here's a remarkable statistic. After the 36 landslide, when the new Congress took office in January of 1937, there were 96 senators at the time for 48 states. Out of those 96, 76 were Democrats. Huh. And not even all of the remaining 20 were Republicans. So we were closer to one-party rule than the nation had been since Reconstruction.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting also today with the phenomenon that we call the emergence of the Tea Party movement, which is attempting to usurp the Just Say No GOP. Do you see any historical parallels regarding the 1930s and today's popular Democratic president?
Well, I think there are some parallels, and it's the organization that you pointed to, the Liberty League. Now, the Liberty League, I should add, is very different than any of the Tea Party organizations that we see right now. The Liberty League desperately wanted to be seen as a grassroots organization. Yeah. But what it really was a group of financial interest, industrial interest. You had people like Alfred P. Sloan and the DuPonts, and E.F. Hutton and so forth, aligning themselves with very conservative Democrats who called themselves Jeffersonian Democrats. That was a label that some used at the time to really suggest small government, states' rights Democrats. And they formed this organization with a lot of fanfare. And to kick off their big campaign against Roosevelt in 1936, and it's hard to imagine anybody making this kind of PR mistake today, rather than having town hall meetings or something like that out at the grassroots, they had a big black tie ball at the Mayflower Hotel here in Washington. And, you know, the women wore their furs and the men wore their tuxedos. And this was lampooned in the press. It was lampooned by Roosevelt. And the league, which had started with such promise from their perspective in 1934, with a lot of talk of ultimately replacing the Republican Party, by the time the 36th election rolled around, the league had become something of a joke, and they had to stay out of the election so that they didn't hurt the Republican Party.
You know, it's and you know, it's interesting how time situation could change by November in this election cycle. Also, there's a lot of enthusiasm for no government, but I don't think we're going to go back to the Articles of Confederation. Before we have our next break coming up, almost immediately after the president's announcements of his plan, which had really been only reviewed by his attorney general, Homer Cummings, there was a storm of protests in the editorial boards and most of the newspapers on the campuses of some of the best private colleges and the floor of the Senate. Senator Bert Wheeler from Montana, a liberal New Dealer, led the fight against the plan. Why did this known liberal and vocal opponent of this conservative core turn against FDR?
Well, this shows you, as much as anything in this fight, the blending of the personal and the political. Bert Wheeler had a huge grudge against Franklin Roosevelt on any number of counts, and I'll only list a few of them here. But Wheeler had actually been one of the first Democrats to get out there and support Roosevelt, even before he started running for president in 1932. But there's some sense that Wheeler may have wanted to be picked as his vice presidential candidate in 1932. He didn't get that. That Wheeler wanted to be named Attorney General. He didn't get that job. Wheeler wanted to drive policy on a number of things that were very important to Wheeler, like silver policy. This was an important thing to him. And Roosevelt tended to cut him out of meetings and so forth. So he had really worked up an incredible head of steam about Franklin Roosevelt by 1935, 1936.
And so it was personal, as they say.
It was very personal, and there was a slight ideological element to it, in that Wheeler, as a progressive, wasn't really in favor of the centralization of power of any kind, whether corporate or governmental. But really, his opposition to Roosevelt at the time of the court fight was driven primarily by this personal grudge, and everybody in Washington understood that.
You know, I want to remind our audience that you are listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest is Mr. Jeff Shessel, the author of Supreme Power, FDR versus the Court, the story behind FDR's attempt to enlarge the Supreme Court by six justices, or one for every judge over the age of 70 that remained on the court. We'll be back in a moment.
Thank you.
made it through a tough winter.
Congratulations, congratulations, congratulations.
Welcome to spring from WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lillian Wu. The president pushing for strong new regulations on Wall Street as he meets with lawmakers from both parties at the White House.
New Hampshire Republican Senator Judd Gregg suggests the president is looking more for political points than bipartisan cooperation.
Taking a hard, very hard line that is very much a political position.
Republicans say the Democrats' reform plan creates a permanent bailout fund. The president says it will not result in bailout.
Fox Radio's Mike Makowicz. Sarah Palin stirring up the crowd at a Tea Party rally in Boston.
We're sending a message to Washington that come November, that big government, big debt, Obama, Pelosi, Reid spending spree, that they're their little children. We're here to take care of you. That agenda is over. We're voting them out. We're going to tell them you're fired.
And high gas readings are keeping investigators from a West Virginia coal mine where 29 miners were killed. Fox News, we report, you decide.
This is Marilyn Caselli from Con Edison. If you're a contractor or homeowner and plan to dig, you need to call 811 before you dig. Utility companies will mark the area of their underground facilities free of charge. Be safe. Before you dig, call 811.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hi there. Talking to Jeff Chesel about FDR, the Supreme Court, the Battle of the 1930s, which is, you know, very much like it is today almost. And it's interesting that maybe a number of Obama's plans will come in front of the courts coming up. It'd be very interesting on the, especially the health care reform. You know, Justice Owen Roberts was a pivotal player in this whole saga regarding control over the philosophical soul of the court. Who was this first Justice Roberts and what role did he play?
Who was Roberts was a question that many people asked at the time, including some of his fellow justices. Roberts was a very personal guy, but he was very hard to know, very hard to understand. And many who had known him for decades before he went on the Supreme Court in 1930 had very different ideas about Roberts' ideology or about his approach to the Constitution. And there was a real question whether he was going to be a liberal justice or a conservative justice. And those questions lingered after his first years on the court. Roberts was an interesting guy. You know, he was the son of a hardware merchant in Philadelphia, and he had gone to the University of Pennsylvania, and he had been a superstar there, gotten his law degree there, and then immediately was hired to teach the law there. He was so impressive. He was incredible in the courtroom. His presentations were legendary, and he wound up being plucked by some of his Republican patrons. Philadelphia was a very Republican city in those days. And he was appointed to lead the investigation of the Teapot Dome scandals that had plagued the Harding administration. And he had actually helped put one of those officials in jail. So he was praised actually by both sides. And when he finally went on the court, as I said, he seemed mostly comfortable with the conservatives on the court, but not always, and had actually authored some important liberal decisions. And so, as I said, these questions lingered, but by 1935, 1936, it seemed pretty clear that he had thrown his lot in with the conservatives. His decisions, he wrote the AAA decision that knocked down the farm program, and he wrote a couple other important opinions as well for the conservative majority. And again, as I said earlier, it wasn't just that these decisions went against the New Deal. They were incredibly strident and even sarcastic in their tone. And it really seemed as if Roberts was entirely lost in the New Deal, and therefore the New Deal was lost.
Right.
Some said at the time that Roberts was the most powerful man in the country because he was deciding the direction of national policy.
And of course, the saying, a switch in time that saved nine, meant what?
A switch in time that saved nine describes the moment in the middle of the fight over the court packing bill, that fight that lasted 6 months, as you described it, between February and July or August 1937. In the middle of that fight, the court switched and suddenly started upholding New Deal programs, or put more accurately, it was Roberts who switched and suddenly aligned himself with the Liberals and with Hughes to create a new 5-4 majority in favor of the New Deal. And so it's the switch in time that saved 9, because it saved them from becoming 15. It saved the court from being packed.
Right.
And it was Roberts who switched, most remarkably, really, on a minimum wage decision. Less than a year before, he had voted to strike down a minimum wage law in the state of New York. And then in the middle of the court fight, he voted to uphold one that was virtually identical in every respect.
So a lot of people really don't know why he made those changes. It's interesting. And Jeff, quickly, I know we're running down on time. What happened to the makeup of the court, and what were the long-term consequences after this? There were changes that came pretty quickly.
Well, that's right. Well, the court switched in that moment, as I described, but Roosevelt was very suspicious, and it turned out rightly so, that after the smoke had cleared, that Roberts would go back and realign himself with the conservatives. And increasingly, that did wind up being the case. But it didn't matter anymore, because one of the conservatives had, by that point, retired, actually announced his retirement in the middle of the court fight deliberately to try to undercut Roosevelt's court packing plan. And so Roosevelt got his chance to appoint his first justice. In August 1937, he appointed the great Hugo Black. And after that, the conservatives saw essentially that the gig was up, and they started to resign with some frequency. And by the time Roosevelt died in 1945, he had appointed 8 of the 9 justices on the Supreme Court, more than any president since George Washington, and certainly more than any president will ever do again. There's some advantage to getting reelected, getting elected 4 times.
Right. You know, it's interesting. So therefore, he lost the battle, but probably won the war regarding the previous legislation, no doubt. In retrospect, with FDR selecting so many justices in the remaining period of time in the White House, the court changed significantly for many decades. Did FDR learn something from this fight about being a more effective leader?
Unfortunately, he didn't learn it quickly enough. He was extremely bitter about the way this all turned out. Yes, he said later that I lost the battle but won the war, meaning that, you know, he had lost the chance to pack the court, but he had helped transform the court. But even that victory didn't give him great satisfaction in that moment. He was very unhappy at all of the betrayals on the Democratic side, Wheeler and the others who had left him. And that bitterness lasted well into 1938, when he actually got involved in the Democratic primaries trying to purge the Democrats who had gone against him. It was a terrible failure and another black eye for Roosevelt. Mm.
You know, What's your conclusion about Charles Evans Hughes, who in the beginning of this struggle over the court, he seems to have this tremendous eminence. In the middle of the struggle, he seems to decline in power, and towards the end of his career, he reemerges as an international, which he always was. What's your view on, is he the forgotten man of this whole situation?
Well, he shouldn't be, but to some extent he's not as well known as he ought to be. He's really one of the towering figures of American history in the 20th century, this man who served as governor of New York, twice as Supreme Court justice, as Secretary of State. He's really a remarkable, remarkable figure, but for all his powers and for all his, they were often referred to as godlike powers at that time, he wasn't able to hold that court together. And I think that the trouble for Hughes in terms of his historical reputation is that he lost the courage of his convictions in that moment. Yeah. He generally seemed to want to side with the liberals, but he really believed that by splitting the difference, he could hold the court together. That was impossible. As I said earlier, it was a court without a center, and he couldn't create one. And it's finally in the middle of the court fight that he seems to regain the courage of his convictions and to write liberal opinions that were not only, it was not simply that they upheld the New Deal, it was that they did so in ringing terms. And he defined a whole new era of constitutional doctrine in which, in many ways, we still live.
Yeah. You know, last year, we all listened to the vetting process and the almost universally expected confirmation of a new Justice Supreme Court with Sonia Sotomayor. This summer, longtime sitting Justice John Paul Stevens will resign from the court and create another opening. Will the fact that President Obama will be replacing a liberal justice make the confirmation hearings a little less rancorous? What do you think on that?
I think they're likely to be rancorous in any event. There is an industry that exists on the right. Indeed, there's an industry that exists on the left, mostly to tear down Supreme Court nominees. And I think they'll do their best. But they may find themselves again confronted by a Sonia Sotomayor, who is very difficult for them to oppose. I'm sure that's certainly the goal of the Obama administration. But I'll tell you this. I think that this battle is going to be a lot less intense than it would have been if it were Scalia who were retiring, and if you were really changing the balance of power on the court.
Isn't it interesting also, since you've written a fantastic book, and I suggest everyone in this listening audience and who's interested in the court read this, isn't it interesting that this is nominally a Protestant country, that there are six Catholics on the court today sitting, two Jewish members, and the only Protestant, John Paul Stevens, who's 90 years old, is resigning, and it doesn't seem that there's a Protestant in the in the offing. Isn't that an amazing phenomena?
It is an amazing phenomenon, and what I also think is amazing about it is that no one seems particularly that concerned about it. I'm not suggesting for a moment that anybody should be concerned about it. What I'm saying is that it's interesting that in a Protestant-majority country that you could have a Supreme Court of nine members without a single Protestant, and nobody feels that it's in any way a big deal. I think that's a really encouraging sign of how far this country has come in religious tolerance. Let's not forget that there were many years when the Ku Klux Klan wasn't only focused on black Americans, it was anti-Jewish Americans, and it was anti-Catholic. It was violently anti-Catholic. And this is, I think, maybe another sign of how far we are along in the post-JFK America, that we could have a Supreme Court with six Catholic members and you're not seeing any increase in anti-Catholic prejudice. So I think it's an encouraging sign.
Right. And, in the last few moments, let's revisit this, the court battle itself very quickly. Couple of quick things to mention. Was the death of Joe Robinson, did that really hurt FDR's effort in the Senate?
It was devastating. As late as July 1937, for all of the missteps and miscalculations and for all the twists and turns that had set Roosevelt back, there was still a very strong chance that Robinson, the Senate Majority Leader, who was such a powerful figure, that Robinson could have gotten Roosevelt a four-judge compromise, a four-justice compromise, so that we would have a Supreme Court of 13 today. But in the middle of that effort, Robinson standing in the well of the Senate, bellowing at his opponents, pounding his fist on the mahogany desk, collapses on the floor, turns purple, and is carried out of the Senate chamber. They tell him to go home and rest for a day, which he does. And when he doesn't come back, his housekeeper goes in to check and finds him dead on the floor of his apartment across from the Supreme Court.
Yeah, we only have 2 minutes left. I just want to say that this has been a very interesting hour. I love the listening. I love the book. There's so many more questions to ask. I know you mentioned in the book about how Judge Rosenman, Sam Rosenman, one of FDR's closest confidants, had said that FDR's refusal to compromise killed the bill. We'll never know on that. And, of course, one of my theories, of course, is that if Louis Howe would have been alive, FDR may not have taken as bold a step. He would have had that alter ego that he missed in regards to this effort, and I think that could have made a difference also. I want to thank you, Jeff, for joining us this afternoon on WVOX and The Advocates. And for more information about his book, please go to the book website at West Wing Writers, and you can read about this. I think it's worthwhile to get it. Next week on WVOX, my guest will be hosting representatives from the Francis Perkins Center up in Maine. We'll be discussing their activities in the 75th anniversary of Social Security. Jeff, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, and I look forward to pushing this book to many of
of my fans, and I think it's a great read. Have a great day. Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Advocates on 1460 WVOX. The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Tune in again next Wednesday at noon for The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX.